and here is our director, Executive Director Stephen Smith, to introduce today's finalist.
Well, thank you, Courtney. Thanks, everybody, for joining. This is the second of our three-part series with the three finalists. Again, my name is Stephen Smith. I'm the Executive Director of the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. We're excited to have Bill Bailey and James Mason on from the National Energy Independence Plan, one of our finalists. Just a little bit about our organization. The Southern Alliance for Clean Energy is a regional nonprofit organization that does work in primarily in five southeastern states, Florida, Georgia, North and South Carolina, and Tennessee. We have historically been focused on reducing the environmental footprint of how we produce and consume energy with an emphasis on the utility sector, but over the last 24 months, as the nation seemed to get more enamored with opening up offshore drilling in a number of southern states, we have begun to look more and more at the transportation sector and the implications of drilling. Sadly, our President Obama in March of this year decided to institute a new policy to advance more aggressive offshore drilling, and 3 weeks later, the Deepwater Horizon rig exploded and sunk to the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, unleashing the devastation that we're continuing to see. And as Courtney said, we're 77, 78 days into this. It's very sad. What we at SACE wanted to do as we began to look at this more and more was try to get the best thinking and try to understand why there's the motivation in the country. What we've been given is this sort of false dichotomy between either you're going to remain addicted to foreign oil from hostile nations that do not have the long-term interest of the United States in mind, primarily coming from the Persian Gulf, or we're going to have to drill in more environmentally sensitive and more risky situations like expanding drilling in the Outer Continental Shelf and in the Gulf of Mexico and going deeper, exceeding the technology limits of what the oil industry itself can actually handle. And unfortunately, what we're witnessing in the Gulf as we speak is the devastation that poor policy decision and the lack of imagination and vision has left us with. So what we're doing with the Gulf Challenge is issuing the challenge to say, how can we end our need to import foreign oil from hostile nations and end our need to engage in risky offshore drilling in the Gulf of Mexico and in other areas?
And now for the National Energy Independence Plan.
First slide, please. This is Bill Bailey. On your right is James Mason. Some call us the odd couple. Thanks are due to Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, all the people who have made this event possible, and those who are participating. I'm a retired Army officer, West Point class of 57, with graduate tickets and experience in quantitative modeling. The NEIP Working Group is a collection of engineers, businessmen, academics, journalists, and scientists who want to do something positive for our nation.
Hi, my name is James Mason. I'm on the right of the screen. My accent is from El Dorado, Arkansas. My PhD is from Cornell, and I live on Long Island. I've been involved in energy all my whole life. The NEIP has grown out of a January 2008 Scientific American article titled The Solar Grand Plan.
Next slide, please, Courtney.
The Solar Grand Plan was authored by Ken Zwabel of George Washington University, Vasilis Sinakis of Columbia University and Brookhaven National Labs, and me with the Hydrogen Research Institute. In addition, I'm the lead author of several peer-reviewed energy articles that underlie both the Solar Grand Plan and the NEIP. The NEIP has two parts, which we call paths. One is Path A, an emergency action to end the need for imported oil. And the other, Path B, is a longer-term national energy system. Path A is completely new, and Path B is adapted from the Solar Grand Plan. Please, next slide, please.
We begin with an outline of the presentation. Our presentation follows a logical progression from objectives through a carefully analyzed solution. The item in blue discusses essential technology that may be unfamiliar to many people.
Next slide, please.
There are two energy threats to the nation. The first threat is that America faces a probability not a fuels will become unaffordable, starting with oil within 1 to 2 decades. Note that we are talking about the cost of oil, not how much remains in the ground. Unaffordability is an economic threat. It requires an economic analysis. The second threat is nationwide and intensifies through mid-century. It cannot be ignored. It is an energy shortfall by mid-century. Next slide, please. As the small slices of the pie on the right of the pie show, of America's total energy consumption, nuclear is 9%. Renewable wind and solar are minuscule, about half of 1%. Next slide, please. The most immediate part of the first threat is imported oil prices. The threat is not a secret. At present, America imports 70% of its oil. The nation must be free of its need to import oil, all 28 QBTU, before the pricing crisis strikes. By the way, we use QBTU rather than barrels of oil or something else because the subject of our conversation is energy. Thinking of all energy in terms of barrel amounts is an implicit acceptance of the 20th century worldview that oil is always going to be the primary energy source. This has to change. We now present three elements of the analysis of the threat of fossil fuel unaffordability. Next slide, please.
We look first at the emerging world oil supply-demand imbalance. The Gulf Challenge's initial 20% oil reduction is a good start, but it's not enough. Why not? We'll get to that, but the crude answer is that China and India are driving demand increases that are faster than world supply increases. When demand outstrips supply, price goes up. This plot shows demand with a red dotted line. It rises from left to right. Demand will go up over time. We know this is driven by China growing at 7% per year and India at 4%, which means that by 2020, these two nations alone will increase world oil demand by 10 million barrels per day. Plans to save energy are good, but insufficient. For example, one of our studies asked the impact of 300 million cars worldwide doubling their fuel economy. Answer, this will reduce demand by 5.2 million barrels per day, still leaving the rest of the 10 million new demand, 5 million barrels per day, from China and India unfulfilled. This omits consideration of any growth from the U.S., Europe, Africa, South America, and the rest of Asia. World supply shows a slowly rising fuchsia line in the graph. We actually think it's flat or falling. But even if we optimistically assume production are increasing slowly, we will reach the same conclusions. When demand outstrips supply, prices go up, catastrophically for a scarce essential resource. Oil will become unaffordable. We will attempt to use natural gas to replace oil, but it will fall short. Then gas, too, will succumb to the same laws of economics. Finally, coal will follow. That's the immediate problem for America to solve, and we can.
Next slide, please. The solid lines are idealized extraction curves for world oil, blue, natural gas, red, and coal, green. The dotted lines are the associated traces for price. Price rises somewhere around the peak because costs are higher and extraction rates are lower after the peak, while demand continues going up. So it is misleading to say we have 100 years of fuel left. Assuming constant or rising demand, when a fuel slows in its production, prices will rise. Next slide, please. Kenneth DeFays of Princeton and Shell Oil stated in 2005 that world oil has already peaked at somewhere around 85 million barrels a day. He uses this graphic to show that the 85 million figure is a peak which acts like a wall. When the wall is hit, prices soar. Next slide, please. In essence, what we have just described can be called a hydrocarbon domino effect. Next slide, please.
What we have just discussed is the serial unaffordability of oil, then gas, then coal. The time remaining before a price shock occurs is much less than is generally accepted. The second threat is a total fossil fuel energy shortfall by mid-century. Next slide.
The Gulf Challenge is, to put the Gulf Challenge into perspective, there are some rough numbers, easy to remember. U.S. annual primary energy use is 100 QBTU. Annual oil is 40 QBTU. Oil imports are 28 QBTU. The Gulf Challenge is 8. The NEIP solves national security problems by insulating the U.S. from a looming world energy catastrophe. Path A is an oil reduction of 28 QBTU within 15 years. In getting there, we will certainly meet the Gulf Challenge's criterion of an 8 QBTU reduction in 10 years. Path B ends the need for as much fossil fuel use as possible before 2050. It turns out that 86% that turns out to be 86% of the total. We cannot end all oil use. For example, petrochemicals, high-performance military aircraft, and other uses will still require some petroleum. Next slide, please.
Now we turn to the time we have available, and this we need to act soon. Next slide, please.
The two threats are too large to ignore. We must craft a response. But what is needed? We propose 10 goals for any solution. One, a solution has to be achievable now using existing scalable technology, including replacing coal. Two, any solution must deliver reliable, dispatchable power, at least as reliable as coal, gas, or nuclear. Three, domestic sourcing of energy is essential for energy security. Hi, this is Bill Bailey. We're back.
Okay, sorry about that. Okay, so sorry
for
the technical.
I was at the end of goals 1 to 5. Shall I pick up there?
Yes, that'd be great.
5. To address the threats, America needs an energy system that can grow with an increasing population and increasing energy demands at home and worldwide. Next slide, please.
Number 6, durability means that with proper maintenance, the system will last long enough to repay the investment many times over. Number 7, affordable. Affordable means that energy is delivered flat price for the rest of the century at no more than 13.5 cents per kilowatt hour and $2.50 per gallon of gas plus tax. Over time, these rates will be very cheap. This is essential for acceptance by the American public and its leadership. Number 8, alignment of public and private interest assures that the taxpayer won't end up paying too much and America won't be beholden to private energy behemoths. Number 9, timely refers to the first threat. If we do not implement a solution soon, an oil price catastrophe might make it impossible to respond. 10, self-funding. Obviously, enormous capital investment is needed in any permanently effective solution. How do we pay for it? Public utilities show us the way. Energy sales through the system produce cash flows to pay the debt service on energy bonds. When the bonds are retired, electricity prices drop from 13.5 cents per kilowatt hour for the rest of the century. No federal subsidies or taxes are needed to fund the system. Next slide, please.
We now turn to the office.
Hold on one moment.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
We should be looking at the,
there
you are. Thank you.
Okay.
America needs to use wind and solar energy. The graphic shows world capacities of different energy sources, and the numbers come from Wikipedia. The big square is solar energy capacity worldwide, 86,000 terawatts. Next, the little yellow square to its right is wind, 870 terawatts. The U.S. energy generation capacity is 1 terawatt, too small to show. Relegating solar and wind to tiny fractions of U.S. energy because, as we shall see, the world's greatest engineering nation cannot solve a simple engineering problem is absolutely unfathomable. Next slide, please.
Next, we'll show that the proposed solutions do not meet the problems. Solutions in the public discourse set the sights too low and too narrowly. The U.S. Department of Energy, for example, has a 20% wind on the grid by 2030 plan, which does not include any energy storage. It is too little, too late. Many other the same. Why have we set our sights so low? We think it's because no one has yet recognized the obvious answer. Next slide, please.
The conventional wisdom is that wind and solar cannot replace coal and natural gas for electrical generation because when the wind does not blow and the sun does not shine, there is no energy. Thus, DOE aims too low. For 20% to 30% wind on the grid by geographic and firming the wind to baseload with natural gas. This approach won't work. Time is too short, geographic mixing is never perfect, and the DOE plan requires twice the natural gas of the solution we shall soon present, which is CAES, compressed air energy storage. First, a new concept. Renewable penetration on the grid means the amount of steady energy at the user's plug furnished by renewable energy. Low levels are in the DOE, but this approach cannot replace coal. High levels can replace coal, but then you need energy storage. The two leading energy storage candidates for are pumped hydro and compressed air energy storage CAES.
Pumped hydro is not readily available because of increasing constraints on water supplies and the need to have a dam in place on a river. By contrast, gas network already stores flammable natural gas at high pressures in underground cavities around the country. On the other hand, storing non-flammable compressed air is a piece of cake. Next slide, please.
In 1978, the first CAES plant was in Dorf, Germany. The second was in McIntosh, Alabama, which has been in constant operation since 1993. CAES uses wind or solar energy to drive electric motors to compress air and store it in underground reservoirs. When power is needed, the compressed air drives a generator that puts power onto the grid. Next slide, please. This little diagram shows how America can solve its energy problems once and for all. The technology is proven. The goal is to provide steady-state electricity on the HVDC grid for delivery to the customer from an intermittent source like wind or solar at A, CAES, B on the diagram, stores some of the energy for later use, HVDC, D on the diagram, is a highly efficient way to transmit all the energy to where it's needed. Here is how they are used to enable wind and solar to fuel a national clean energy system. Consider the following cases. When the wind is blowing, wind energy, which is never, ever totally steady, moves directly to the HVDC grid. The CAES plant both stores energy and feeds small amounts to the grid at sea to keep the current steady. When the wind stops blowing, the CAES plant delivers full capacity to the grid via sea. Depending on design, CAES can deliver full capacity to the grid for as long as 2 months. Now, HVDC. The distance limit for conventional AC transmission is roughly 300 miles before losses tend to become uneconomical and rise over about 15% to 20%. The limit largely dictates how generating stations around the nation have been distributed, coincident with population. HVDC transforms the geographic relationships. With losses on the order of 10% for 2,000 miles, CAES need not be collated with the energy source. Both the energy source and storage can be far distant from population centers and still have better total efficiency than distributed wind or solar near population centers. We get the best of both worlds, maximum generation and minimum losses. Overall efficiencies are impressive. 70% of power at the solar farm reaches the customer's plug, more than double the efficiencies of the current system. These efficiencies help us achieve our goal of not raising average energy prices in the United States. Next slide, please.
We now turn to America's options. America can choose to patch up its fossil-based energy system or replace it. Next slide, please.
I just wanted to let you gentlemen know that we are at the 20-minute mark.
First, the fossil option. A patch to the fossil system means finding more oil, gas, and coal, and this strategy has fatal flaws. It is ever harder to find and ever more costly. The question is, how long will fossil fuels provide provide affordable fuel. Our bet, 1 to 2 decades. But the viability and necessity of our solution does not depend on this bet. Even if we're off by several decades, we'll still need the NAIP. Next slide, please.
We have an alternative. The replace option is to engineer and to build a replacement national energy system. With an engineered system, the price at the plug and the pump can be designed in. There is no need to explore and no need to drill for fuel. Because fuel, the wind and the sun are free, there are no price increases even as the world runs out of fossil fuels. As an engineered system, the new system is designed to be ample, clean, secure from attack through size and redundant paths, reliable and domestically sourced. The current energy system so far has cost about $14 trillion. The NEIP has two paths with capital costs of $2 trillion and $15 trillion. The largest costs are incurred after a decade or two when the solar phase begins. The paths are self-funding using a public utility model. Cash flows from energy sales through the system exceed $1 trillion per year. That's ample for debt service on $17 trillion. After debt retirement in about 30 years, the price of electricity to the consumer, as long as the public utility model is used, can drop from 13.5 cents to 5 cents per kilowatt hour. That is our vision, a future of cheap, plentiful, renewable, clean energy to power America's world leadership. Next slide, please.
The question
and
we asked...
I'm sorry to bother to interrupt again, but we are going to extend it 3 additional minutes for the technical interruption.
Thank you. The question is, why are we looking at electricity as a solution? The reason is electrification has massive benefits in the terms of efficiency gains. For example, two-thirds of the chemical energy in fossil fuels is wasted as heat, ceding to electric systems a 3-to-1 efficiency advantage. This points inescapably to a conversion of national energy to a primarily electric system. Once conversion to an electric economy is complete, the savings are about $1 trillion per year, and we will easily meet the Copenhagen CO2 emission standards. Self-interest justifies action now. Next slide, please. Here's what the two paths will accomplish. Next slide, please. The NIP's program delivers 9 QBT of liquid fuels by first gasification of coal, then replacing the coal with biofuels, cellulosic biomass for biofuels, in the form of diesel and jet fuel, plus about 10% of the electricity is co-generated by the national electricity system. It does so, these liquid fuels, at a 28% reduction in CO2 emissions using technology in place today. As can be seen from the numbers for light cars and trucks, 48% of the total electrification of these light vehicles is essential to ending imported oil. The electricity for the building of the light vehicles program is furnished by the wind portion of Path A, an amount about equal to the current U.S. generation system, 1 terawatt of capacity and about 4,000 terawatt hours per year of delivered electricity. Next slide, please. The NIP is not an austerity program. Look at the cars in the slide. Current vehicle size and weight are assumed. In all the NIP modeling, we convert the U.S. light vehicle fleet to electricity starting today merely by requiring all new cars to be electric powered. That's 17 million cars per year. Sure, this will take government incentives to get going, and some time for manufacturers to accelerate their ramping up of capacity. But the important point is it's something that is obviously feasible, and it will have a huge impact. The NEIP works with both fuel cell vehicles and plug-in electric vehicles. Fuel cell vehicles seem to have the edge because of the speed of refueling. Electric vehicles are not future technology. Daimler and Honda have market-ready cars on the road today, and Germany has already mandated a national hydrogen refueling network by 2015. Next slide, please.
An effective response to the Gulf Challenge is to be part of a larger plan. Here is Path B, which overlaps with Path A. This slide shows how the national generation system can be replaced. It is a slightly more detailed version of the schematic we looked at 8 slides ago. At the top of the slide is the electric generation component of the NEIP, wind and solar in the center of the nation. At the middle of the slide, intermittent power from wind and solar flows down to CAISE in a central mediating role. At the bottom of the slide, HVDC, represented by the heavy blue arrows at the bottom, efficiently distributes power to the rest of the country. At lower right, just disconnect the local power plant and connect to the national grid's HVDC downlink. Next slide, please.
Aligning public and private interest through the public utility model is the most efficient way for us to go, providing the lowest price to the consumer. There is no quarterly profit burdens. The final ownership of the system remains with the ratepayer. Plan execution is likely to be on an emergency basis because we have to get started before a world economic oil shock strips us of the needed resources. To put this into effect, we propose that the program be run by a federal agency model on the historical successes like the NASA Moon Program, the Nuclear Submarine Construction Program, and the Eisenhower National Interstate Highway System. Next slide, please. The NEIP meets all elements of the challenges, deals with emissions, and builds a sustainable total energy system for the U.S. throughout the 21st century. Next slide, please. The question is, why don't we start now?
This ends our presentation. We're open to questions. Thank you.